Well, you have made it over the twists and turns of Route 17, and you've got all of your week's activities behind you. You're looking forward to a holiday weekend. There's just one thing standing between you and a restful weekend, and that's me and about 40 minutes of talking. And I was thinking about what Americans like to do on Memorial Day weekend, and listening to addresses on the subject of culture was not in the top 65 items or so. So I'm not sure why you're here, but I'm here, well, first of all, because I love this church, and I have been so blessed to be part of little pieces of your life, especially over the last year. I love it that it's a church that sings songs that I can't sing anywhere else because they don't know them yet. I love that we come to a place as beautiful and particular and wonderful as this, that there's nothing like it anywhere else. So I'm just delighted to be with you. And I am going to just ask of you something that most Americans don't have to give on their Memorial Day weekend, which is a certain amount of focus and attention. Because the things that we're going to be talking about are not particularly simple, and they're not initially all that entertaining, frankly. I meant to bring my sort of funny story that every talk is supposed to begin with, and I just forgot to prepare one. So consider a funny story to have been told, chuckles to have filtered through the room. Perfect. See, you're a very compliant audience. And we're just going to dive in and talk about culture, talk about what we mean when we say this word culture. And as we go through the weekend, we'll either get much more fun or much more boring, depending on how it goes. We'll just see what happens. I have a little clicker here that is supposed to reach all the way to the back. But there's a lot of people between me and there, so I'm going to just raise my arms in the air as if I am giving praise to God every time I want the slide to change. So you'll just understand what's happening. It's not actually an ecstatic expression of worship as much as an invocation to the gods of technology to please provide me with the next slide. So when we say this word culture, if we have not been contaminated by a skit about culture already, what do we think? Well, we might think of biological culture if we're a biologist or a scientist who spends time culturing little beasties in test tubes and so forth. We might think of high culture, so that culture is something that a certain kind of person cares about. You know, oh, that's a cultured person. Or I think I'll go to the museum and take in some culture, you know, as if I couldn't get it anywhere else, but if I go to the museum or maybe the orchestra or the symphony, I can get some culture. Or we might be more popular than that and think, well, culture is kind of all of the arts, not just the high arts, but it would include the music that's on my iPod. It would include the movie that's in the theaters tonight. I think it's Pirates of the Caribbean Part 7 or something like that. Why are you guys here and not at Pirates of the Caribbean? I don't understand. they had no choice. That's the answer. So we might think of it as just these sort of imaginative things that some people do. You know, there's some people who make culture, but most of us, we just have sort of ordinary lives. We're not part of culture. I want to have us think about culture in a very different way this weekend. It's something that all of us are involved in, and I want to give us a definition of culture that we're going to carry through the weekend. Now, there are a number of folks who are going to be with us, I am sure, who are currently on one of the many so-called freeways that I understand you have out here in California, which look to me more like parking lots. So they will arrive late, and you'll need to fill them in on this because it's very foundational for what we're going to do. I've read a lot of academic books about culture. I've tried to memorize a lot of long definitions of what culture is, and none of them have stuck. But one did. It's not, I didn't make this up, but it's from a guy named Ken Myers, who has a wonderful program called the Mars Hill Audio Journal. And Ken defined culture this way. I like it because it's only basically seven words. Culture is what human beings make of the world. Everything we do this weekend is going to be very simple like this. Like I said, either very fun or very, very boring, depending on your point of view. Because
This is all we have to say to really say what culture is. It's what human beings make of the world. And then Ken adds this wonderful little addition. Oh, God of technology, please bring me the rest. In both senses. What human beings make of the world, in both senses. Now, what does that mean? Well, what probably first comes to mind when you hear the phrase, what people make of the world, you think, well, people make stuff out of the world, right? The things we make. So culture is all of the things that human beings make out of the raw material they find all around them in nature or in creation. So we find cotton plants and we cultivate them and harvest them and spin the cotton, card the cotton, do whatever they do to the cotton, and we end up with clothing, right? So clothing is culture. It's something that we made. We didn't find these, you know, did not grow on cotton trees. They were made into clothing by human beings. They made it out of the world. Some human beings cut down some trees and made them into benches. We're sitting on culture right now. Someone else took silicon and made it into a laptop that's projecting a presentation. That's culture. So all these things that we make, all the things that human beings make, the food that we had to eat tonight, the songs that we sang, the musical instruments that were played, all these things fall in this broad category of what human beings make of the world. But I love what Ken says. He says it's what human beings make of the world in both senses, because there's another meaning to that phrase, right? What you make of the world. It's what you'd say to your neighbor if I say something confusing. You'd turn to them and you'd say, what do you make of what Andy just said, right? And then you aren't asking that person to make an actual thing. You're asking them about meaning, about sense. What is the meaning of the world? So culture is not just about making stuff. It's also about making sense. It's not just about making things, but also meaning. Why is that? Because this world does not come with any explanation. And yet, don't we sense there must be some explanation for this world? It's a beautiful world. It's a wonderful world. It's also a terrifying, mystifying, sometimes very frightening world. And what meaning do we make of it? Well, human beings do not land on this planet and have a built-in meaning. We don't know. So we start to try to search it out, and that's the process of culture. And the really interesting thing about these two senses of what human beings make of the world is that they're connected. Because the way we make sense of the world is to make things from the world. The way we make meaning from the world is to make more stuff. And the more cultural artifacts we make, the more goods we make, the more stuff we make, the more we're trying to work out, ultimately, what is the meaning of this world we find ourselves in. Now, we've all done this. So let me give you kind of an example. Every presentation needs a baby. Here's the baby. This is not my baby. It's baby number one on Google Images if you search for baby. We were all babies once upon a time. We had a fairly simple life. We really had three needs: to be dry, to be fed, and to be well rested. When one or more of those fundamental needs was not satisfied, we cried, and hopefully our parents took care of them. But when all three were satisfied, we were dry, we'd had something to eat, and we had had a good amount of sleep, we didn't have much else to do. And we didn't have a lot we could do because we had not yet discovered our appendages. This was before the point at which, you know, you find out that the hand can, like, grab the foot, which creates great excitement in families for some reason when babies do that. At least the first few times. When you get to be about 13, it really doesn't impress anymore. Really, about the only part of our body or our environment that we had any control over was our vocal tract. We had lungs, we had a larynx, we had a tongue, we had a resonating passages in our heads. And we could move air through all this and make sounds. So we lay in our little crib and we just made little sounds. First, very unsophisticated sounds, you know, ah, 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 ah. And then one day we discovered, without even really trying, that you could put your lips together and make what's called a labial consonant and go ba, 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 ba. So we tried that for several days. One day we moved on from the labial consonant to what's called the dental consonant, which is where you put your tongue behind your teeth and you vocalize it at the same time and it goes da, 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 da. And when we did that one day, something quite extraordinary happened. A very important person in our life suddenly appeared over the crib, looking down at us, and in a loud, happy voice said, "He's saying daddy." Well, that was pretty good, so we tried it again. Da, 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 da. "Yes, daddy, that's me, I'm your daddy." Now, actually, when my son said this, he was referring to the doggy. So we got rid of the doggy. And then Dada meant daddy. So we suddenly discovered that this stuff we were making out of the world, da da da, sounds, right? Taking the raw material of air and sound waves and our own bodies, the stuff we were making, hey, that connected up with a really important person. It made sense of our world because that was the name for that person. And then he realized that person had sort of been calling himself Dada all the time. He would, you know, when you were little, he'd come up to you and say, "Yeah, I'm your daddy, daddy." Well, you started to realize, oh my goodness, I can make stuff that makes sense. I can make something with the raw materials just of my created body and the world that God created. I can make sense of the most, maybe second most important person in my life. And then we started acquiring language, right? And basically what language is one, it's maybe the fundamental form of human culture. Because as we started to use just the raw materials of our vocal tracts to make sense of the world started to make more sense. We started to discover connections in it and patterns in it that we didn't even know were there before we acquired language. That's what culture is. Making stuff, even stuff as simple as a sound, that then sort of hooks up the connections in the right way so that you say, hey, the world makes more sense now than it did before. Now, it's not just the beginning of every human life that has this quality of making stuff and making sense. Oh, please, technology gods, one more time I beg unto you. When we go back into the very earliest traces of human beings, the way we know they're human is really roughly three things. There are three things at the earliest layer of anthropological or archaeological records of human beings. There's signs of domesticated animals, that is, taking the raw material of you know, wolves and sort of gradually bringing them into the family circle as dogs eventually. There's tools, and amazingly, there's art. As early as domesticated animals and tools, we find art. We find things like these cave paintings in Lascaux, France, that are not small. You know, this is not someone just sort of doodling on the cave wall. You know, Jorg, or whatever his name is bored, and he thinks, well, you know, me draw cattle, you know. No, this is actually about, I forget how big this one is, but some of them are 3 to 4 meters wide, and they're on the ceilings of caves that are as high as the ceiling of this auditorium. So that there had to be a whole team of people making scaffolding or something to get these folks up to then draw these huge representations of what they were seeing out in the world. Our earliest ancestors, the earliest traces we can find of them, they're already doing this. They're making something using pigments that they find in the world around them to try to make sense of this mysterious, wonderful, terrible world they're in. It's the first thing we do. Let's talk about one other feature of culture. As we engage in this stuff-making, sense-making activity, something interesting happens. Remember, what's the definition of culture? It's what human beings make of the world. Well, over time, as we make more stuff, the stuff we make becomes part of the world that we have to make something of. This is the most difficult concept I will present tonight, so, and it's late in the week. So let me say that again. Over time, human culture accumulates. We don't start over from scratch every time. We don't invent language, for example. No, we come into a world that other people have already shaped before us, and the culture that they've handed on to us is just part of the world that we have to make something of ourselves. So someone else built this auditorium. We don't have to arrive at Mount Hermon and set about building a place to meet in. We've already got a place to meet in, but now we have to do something in this. And it's just part of our world. It's like the furniture, right? It literally is the furniture. So over time, culture doesn't just get restarted every generation. It accumulates and more becomes the world that human beings have to relate to. I sometimes like to illustrate this by seeing how many rivers an audience can name. Now, this is you are all from Berkeley, so you are all very smart, I understand. So you probably can name a lot of rivers. But I personally know very few rivers, because you don't really need to know much about the rivers of the United States to live in the United States now, right? But I guarantee you in the 19th century, people knew the name of every major river, because that was the world that they navigated through, right? And when you got to them, crossing them was a big deal. Well, now, what we have to know is the names of the interstate highways. So I know very well, you know, for instance, how many of you know, east-west highways, are they even-numbered or odd-numbered? Yeah. We all know that. Well, almost all of us know that. Now we all know that. It's actually really cool. The even ones are east-west and the odd ones are north-south. It's really cool. So now what's part of the world we have to deal with? Not just rivers, but interstates. And in a way, they're much more important, really, for us than the rivers are. So over time, culture becomes the world that we have to make something of. And when it does, it starts to define what I want to call the horizons of the possible and the impossible. So what culture is what human beings make of the world. But what it does is define for us what's possible and what's impossible, what can be done and cannot be done. Now, this is very easy to illustrate because I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, just outside Philadelphia, and I was there just over 24 hours ago. Now, how can I be there 24 hours ago and here tonight? Well, it's very easy. I didn't actually have to do anything except provide a credit card, and I got in this little aluminum tube, and I read a few magazines and watched a couple of movies, Casino Royale and so forth, and strangely, I found myself in San Francisco. Well, that's culture, right? It's the culture of air travel, all of the very complex systems that go into the culture of air travel made it possible for me, just easily possible. No effort really required at all, except the effort to sit in one place for 6 hours without moving. Very, very easy to do. But culture also makes things that used to be possible at least much more difficult, if not impossible. Now, I was trying to think of a contextualized West Coast example of this, and I was not totally successful, so you have to bear with me. I'm from this place called the East Coast, where, by the way, where the freeways do not have the word "the" in front of them. We do not understand when you say the 95. What is this the 95 of which you speak? We don't understand that. Well, in the East Coast, we also have this thing that's unfamiliar in California called history. We have like hundreds of years of it. In public speaking class, they taught us how to win over an audience. So I was reading one of these works of history, David McCullough's book, John Adams, about one of the founders. And in this long book, John Adams rides back and forth from Philadelphia to Boston, the two major cities of the colonies at that time, on a horse, right? He does this probably half a dozen times at least in the course of his adult life. And it's quite natural and normal, and it's really, it's just sort of filler for the story. It doesn't matter. He just rode on his horse. No big deal. I started to ask myself, would it be possible now to ride on a horse from Philadelphia to Boston? I've concluded that basically the answer is no. It would not be possible. It would not be kind to the horse. And if you were to do it, it would have to be as part of like a PBS reality show. You know, you'd have a camera crew following you on this arduous journey to get the horse from Philadelphia to Boston. Why? It was totally possible 210 years ago to do that. No trouble really at all. Why is it impossible now, or at least very, very difficult? Because of culture. Human beings have made more stuff. They've made interstate highways. And they have little signs with a picture of a horse and a line drawn through it at every entrance. No horses. And, of course, there was a whole cultural infrastructure back then for traveling by horse. There were inns a day's journey along, right? So you could sort of go from inn to inn. There would be food for your horse, food for you, place to stop, place to sleep. All that's gone now. Now we have Cracker Barrel restaurants, but they're not quite the same. Oh, you guys don't have those out here. See? But you do have In-N-Out Burger, and I made my pilgrimage yesterday. So, but that wouldn't help the horse. So see, some things have become totally possible. In-N-Out Burgers have become totally possible since the time of John Adams. But other things that were completely possible for John Adams and his contemporaries are now really, for all practical purposes, impossible. So culture, and it's culture that did both. It made some things possible, other things impossible. It doesn't just expand the horizons of possibility, it also moves the horizon. So things that used to be in the world we could easily imagine and participate in suddenly become just unimaginable. Could never do that. That just never could work. And of course then, as human beings keep doing this process of making more stuff to try to make sense, it's within those horizons that we create more culture. Because it keeps accumulating. We keep doing it. We keep making more language. I learned an amazing thing when I studied linguistics in college. I found that my professors believed, with good reason, that every human being who's acquired basic facility in language, certainly everyone here, has spoken a sentence that no one else has ever spoken in the history of that language. The odds just are, you know, we've got enough vocabulary, syntax is complicated enough, that you have said something that no human being has ever said before you. You made another little piece of culture, whatever that sentence was. So culture becomes the world we have to make something of, defines the horizons of what's possible and impossible. And then within those horizons, human beings just go on doing this. We just keep making more stuff and trying to make more sense. Well, that's about enough talking for me, so let's have some interaction with this. Let's do a couple of case studies. And here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to propose just 5 questions you can ask about any piece of cultural stuff. Call it any cultural good is what I like to call them, cultural goods. They can be intangible like language, that can be very tangible like a microphone stand or a little remote clicker or whatever you want. You can ask these questions. We'll put up 2. What does this cultural good assume about the way the world is? Because culture always starts, has to make something of the world as it is, as we find it. So what does this cultural good start with? What piece of the world is it trying to make something of? And then, because culture is always sort of stretching towards the sense, the meaning in the world, what does this cultural good assume about the way the world ought to be? What does it want the world to be like that it isn't like right now? So those are the first 2 questions, is and ought to be. And then we can ask these 2 questions, this pair of questions, what does it make possible? And what does it make impossible? Or at least much more difficult. And then finally, since people are always adding on, they're always creating more of it, once this cultural good is in the world, what new culture do people make now that it's there? What do they make of it in the next round? So we can ask these 5 questions. So I want us to actually do that together. I'm not going to do the work now. I'm going to just walk around and listen. And in a moment, I'd like you to find like 4 people-ish near you on your bench. Are they pews if you're in an auditorium? I think they're benches. And let's take a couple different cultural goods and ask these questions about. Let's do the first. What shall we do first? Oh, yes. You might have heard of this. It's called the iPod. How many iPods are in the room right now? Most of them will be concentrated over here, I sense. Here we have a real live iPod, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who haven't encountered them, made by this obscure company called Apple. Let's ask these questions about the iPod. Okay, so think about the iPod. Find about four people, and why don't you just start with the first two? Don't go on to possible impossible yet. Just take about 5 minutes and come up with some good answers to these first two questions. What does it assume about the way the world is? And what does it assume about the way the world ought to be? And then we're going to hear some of what you said. All right? Go for it. All right. Finish your thoughts. All right. I'd like to hear just a few answers. I'm going to come back into the darkened auditorium. You understand culturally why it's dark back here. It's because you all are not important, and I am. So I got the look. So if you heard something, rather than saying your own brilliant idea, if you heard someone else in your little conversation say something interesting, raise your hand and tell me what you heard that was kind of striking about how the way the world is or the way the world ought to be. Someone in this general vicinity? Yeah.
My neighbor here said that we... Oh, sorry.
You're getting more important. Yes.
Hey, whoa. Spotlight time. That I assume the world should provide music for me.
Yes.
On demand. And yes. I don't have to listen to commercials.
Good. Yes.
It's there when I want it.
Yes.
And I can pretend like I'm doing something else, but I'm listening to music.
Wow, a great list. Yes. Life. I should have a soundtrack. Why does only Brad Pitt get a soundtrack? I need a soundtrack for my life. The world should be that way. There was a hand here. Yeah.
It assumes the importance of individuality.
Ah,
our
yes.
Our experience of music should be alone.
It is not called the Wii Pod, is it? Okay, yeah.
It assumes that silence isn't a good thing.
So the world should not be too quiet, because that might be uncomfortable. Yes, I think that's right. That's excellent. I'm going to come around to this side. Someone over here must have said something for all of us to hear. Hands. Someone hear something interesting from your neighbor? Yeah.
I no longer have to listen to any tune that isn't the coolest, in my opinion.
Yeah, I should be able to select. In fact, I should be able to sort of disaggregate the album. If they made some songs that I don't like on the album, I should be able to just listen to the ones I like. Yes, excellent. Yeah.
It assumes familiarity with technology.
Excellent, thank you.
That's and a certain amount of disposable income.
Absolutely, absolutely. Right, that's very important. Two really good points. Assumes a certain amount of affluence that we have. And then it also, if we didn't have personal computers already and the internet and so forth to download the music, this thing couldn't have been created. So it was built on all these other things. Yeah, keeping on this side. One more maybe, down this way. Your neighbors were not interesting down here, I guess.
There's a sense that if someone can find the music, that it's theirs, whether they paid for it or not.
Okay, that gets into possible and impossible, I suppose. It makes it possible to steal and music and for that to seem pretty normal and not a problem. Let's actually turn back to that same group and work on these three bottom questions. What does it make possible? And make sure you come up with at least one answer to what does it make impossible or a lot more difficult, and then what new culture is created in response. Take 5 minutes to do that with that same group of folks. Okay, finish your thoughts. Somebody over here have a good answer?
Yes, we do.
Have one? Okay. All right, so let's hear a few answers from around the room. We'll start down here. What does it make possible or impossible? Bonus points for impossible. Because you see, when Steve Jobs gets up, you know, to promote his next new thing, he always talks about what it's going to make possible. He rarely says, once we have sold 200 million iPods, you will no longer be able to blank, right? He doesn't ever sell it that way, but you will no longer be able to avoid it. All right, so what did you guys come up with?
Well, it's going to be impossible to buy an 8-track.
Yes, thank you. Absolutely. Very good. Absolutely. It is totally impossible to buy an 8-track. You are right.
It makes it possible to go deaf at a much early age.
That makes deafness more likely or hearing more difficult.
Well, it's impossible to use it without interconnectivity. Because how do you get anything on it unless you connect it to something?
Yes, right.
So it's dependent.
So doesn't it, it's sort of part of a larger phenomenon, right, of things that just make it hard for us to imagine ever being anywhere where we're not connected, because our things won't work, and our things are us, and so we won't work. Yes?
You have something to say about that.
Oh, okay.
We were talking, it makes it impossible or more difficult to be cool without one. And then relevant.
How true. I actually own a, I think it's a second generation iPod. It's the sort of click wheel one. And I recently was out with it, and I realized that I felt that I had a fat iPod. And I actually felt uncool carrying an iPod because it wasn't the current svelte slim iPod. So, yes, possible or impossible?
Impossible, but I cannot wait my iPhone.
It makes it possible to be completely absorbed in the iPhone speculation, yes. All right, let's see. How will I get the mic over to you? I have no idea. Mind handing it over?
It makes it possible to listen to podcasts where you can take any foreign language that you want to. You can listen to any college lectures. You can watch your favorite TV shows. You can watch your favorite movies.
Yes. Yeah, so think about all the kinds of experiences that are available that were maybe not totally impossible, but it just makes it so much easier. Yeah, that's excellent. That's excellent.
What it makes possible is for the culture to give us a definition of what is real by what we download, but what's making impossible is for us to connect with reality.
It does have that effect of separating us, doesn't it? And creating this thing between our ears that seems more real in some ways than what's actually out there. I think that's right. All right, I think I want to do one more exercise like this just so you don't think this is a like pro or anti iPod talk. So let's do something rather different. So same questions, same group of people. Oh no, I should have said Pete's. I'm sorry. All right, so I know that we are all deeply biased against the evil Seattle Starbucks, but try to be fair, and this time you can sort of take whichever question seems most interesting to you related to Starbucks, okay? Do that for a few minutes together. All right, this is probably about as long as you can bear to talk about Starbucks, so. All right, we had one good idea here.
Okay, so my friendly neighbor here said that it's a status thing, like in Japan, when Starbucks went to Japan, everybody thought they would be crazy because everybody drinks tea in Japan, but when they got there, then it became a status thing where all the people would pay money and spend a lot of money to buy Starbucks just to have it and be cool, I guess.
Wow. Isn't that interesting?
And the statistics now show that more people drink coffee than tea in Japan.
Wow. It's amazing. Do you know the city in the world with the most Starbucks? It's actually London. And the British are switching. You used to think of British tea, but so it's making, on the one hand, it's making possible, let's say in Japan, it's making possible kind of a new set of taste experiences. that weren't part of the culture before. But inevitably, because people can only be drinking one thing at a time, it's shifting, right? Now, will it ever make it impossible to get a cup of tea in Japan? Maybe not. But it's starting to shift kind of the... I sometimes think about this possibility-impossibility thing not as sort of binary, you know, on or off, but sort of a... It's like a hill. What's the most natural thing to do? Culture tells you, you know, sort of what's downhill, what's easier versus what's uphill, what's harder. And it starts to shift that gradient a little bit. Something else that you heard from one of your neighbors, sure, down here.
It assumes that most people can't tell the difference between good coffee and bad coffee.
Okay. This could really get out of hand. Yes.
I don't know if we're on to new culture, but one of the people in our group said cup holders in cars.
Oh, like, yes.
Every car ad talks about the cup holders.
Right, right. So, exactly. People start, and we didn't talk about that with the iPod, which is too bad because there's so many new things, right? New products, you know, socks for your iPod, as well as new music that's made. I'm going to go way back here for like two more comments. Do you mind handing this over?
Friends don't let friends drink Starbucks.
All right, really. This is unchristian, people. All right, a substantive comment, please, for our last.
And you're giving it to the teenager.
Sorry, say it.
Why are you giving that to... Anyway, there's a whole new language. Instead of large, there's grande.
Yes. Venti. Don't... Do not go to Italy and ask for something venti. That is not an Italian word. It actually means to break wind in Italian, so don't use it. Okay. So, is the iPod, or is... Well, this crowd is not going to... answer this question rightly with Starbucks. But are these things good or bad? Thank you. Isn't it complicated? Right? It's complicated because every cultural good, and these are two very complex cultural goods, they have a lot of different parts to them, a lot of different components. Every cultural good starts out by in some ways accurately seeing the world as it is, and in some ways kind of very appropriately envisioning some way the world ought to be, and makes some really good things possible. But then on the other hand, it makes other things impossible or a lot more difficult. It starts to sort of change the shape of the hill in ways that maybe aren't so good. So with the iPod, you know, I am just old enough and I've been flying frequently enough in my life to remember when it was more common than not to greet your seatmate when you sat down on a flight, right? And you wouldn't talk the whole flight, but you'd have a little conversation. That was sort of the norm, not every time, but most of the time. But now I fly a lot, and it's very rare that I have any kind of engagement with my seatmate, not even because they have the iPod on, because the iPod has changed the way we do sociability in our culture. So it does all these good things, but then that feels like a loss, whereas places like Starbucks, better places than Starbucks, let's say, have actually sort of opened up new spaces for sociability, but maybe at the cost of, frankly, breaking our wallets for $4 venti mocha, et cetera. I was going to do one more. The Prius would have been interesting to do this since your pastor drives one. But we could do this with anything. And this is the wonderful thing about doing this exercise on Friday night. Now, if you're having an awkward moment sitting at a dining table with someone you don't know, you can just pick anything in culture and ask these questions about it. They work with anything. And it's fascinating to ask these questions. I want to end, though, with one example just to make sure that we get how real this is, how real culture is, how much it changes our lives. It's an example that's about 5 years old, and some things have actually changed for the better since I pulled this anecdote out of a London paper. But I think it's worth dwelling on. It's about the diagnostic procedure called amniocentesis. I'm just going to read, this is kind of a précis or a summary of an article that appeared in the Daily Telegraph in April of 2002. A British government minister has condemned the selective abortion of children with Down syndrome. Brian Wilson, a new Foreign Office minister, said that the use of amniocentesis tests for Down syndrome, which resulted in the elimination of 95% of children found to have the condition, was grotesque. Mr. Wilson, who has a 9-year-old son with Down syndrome, also condemned the fact that the assumed social good of eliminating Down syndrome babies was considered so important that 400 unborn children without Down syndrome died as a result of amniocentesis tests each year in Britain in order to identify 100 children with the condition. Mr. Wilson added that the loss of so many Down syndrome children to abortion meant that the few who do make it into the world were not given the care which should be given to them in a civilized society. This is culture. Someone creates a procedure, an amniocentesis test that can identify Down syndrome. They're not intending all of its consequences. But one of its consequences is a lot of complications. And this has gotten a little better in the last 5 years, by the way, the complication rate. But at this time, the complication rate is such that to find 100 children with Down syndrome, you're going to have, unfortunately, the test itself is going to lead to the unintended death of four times that number. And then the 100, because it's assumed that it's very difficult to bring up Down syndrome babies or it wouldn't be appropriate to let them come to term, 95 of them are going to be aborted. So out of 500 children, 495 never make it into the world in order to avoid having Down syndrome babies. And then what happens? See, the gradient starts to change. The hill starts to move. And it becomes harder and harder to imagine having a Down syndrome baby because there aren't very many of them and there aren't many support structures for them. So, of course, what are you more likely to do? Well, you're more likely to feel if you get that diagnosis that you can't handle it. And so then, of course, it becomes more true until it becomes impossible or nearly impossible, in all practical terms, too difficult to imagine raising a baby with this condition. Now, again, I'm just old enough that I remember when I was a teenager, let's say, 20 years ago, going into the grocery store, and you'd often see families with Down syndrome babies. And while our rate in the U.S. is not as high as this, it is well above 50% of babies who are aborted when this diagnosis is given. And it's just occurred to me as I sort of look around, you see fewer and fewer families with this. Now, is this because children with Down syndrome are unhappy? Actually, if you've ever met any folks with Down syndrome, they are not unhappy people by and large. They are probably happier than most of us. No, it's because of culture. It's because of what culture tells you is possible and impossible. So it's important as we go through the rest of our weekend together to remember that when we say culture, it can sound very abstract. It can sound very sort of vague. But it really does make things possible and impossible. Makes life possible. Makes life impossible. And this is the world in which, for the rest of our weekend, we're going to try to figure out our Christian response. Thank you all very much for your attention tonight. Look forward to being with you for the rest of the weekend.